Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for a half hour each weekday morning, Monday through Friday. Today is Friday, the last opportunity for us to talk together before the weekend. And if you'd like to be on the program, you can do so right now. We have a line open for you at 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith or any related topic, feel free to give me a call. If you have a different viewpoint than the host and want to bring that up, feel free to do that too. Our first caller today is Jack calling from Stockton, California. Jack, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve. Merry Christmas to you and your family.
Same to you. Thank you.
I have a question concerning premillennialism. I have just within the last couple of years changed my view to more of a partial preterism. And one of the things that I read from partial preterists or preterists is that dispensationalism is a relatively new understanding started by John Nelson Darby in the 1830s.
Right.
But I read this quote from a guy in the 3rd century, Ephraim the Syrian. Have you ever heard of him?
Pseudo-Ephraim is called, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just a short quote. Could I read it to you real quick?
Sure, I've read it, but go ahead.
It says, this was written in 373, "For all saints and elect of God are gathered prior to the tribulation that is to come and are taken to the Lord, lest they see the confusion that is to overwhelm the world because of our sins." And so that would seem to imply that there was a premillennial understanding at that time in church history. But I was just wondering, how legitimate is this quote, or is it something that we could say is a legitimate view of the church at that time?
Right. Well, first of all, no one should doubt that there was a premillennial view of eschatology in the first 4 centuries. Irenaeus was premillennial, Justin Martyr was premillennial, Papias was, Hippolytus, Tertullian, they were premillennial. Now, you're probably thinking of dispensational. Dispensational is, a dispensational person is going to be premillennial.
Right.
But premillennialists are not all dispensationalists. The claim is that dispensationalism was not around before 1830. John Nelson Darby is the founder of dispensationalism. Anyone can look that up in any encyclopedia or online and discover that this is true. Dispensationalism is traced to John Nelson Darby in 1830 and the Plymouth Brethren movement. No one who's knowledgeable about church history doubts this, but there are some things that dispensationalists teach that have been taught for a long time before them. For example, the virgin birth. You know, dispensationalists believe in the virgin birth. So did Christians throughout history. Dispensationalists believe there's going to be a millennium when Jesus comes back. Well, there were some Christians in the early church who believed that too, but there were some who didn't. The idea of a future millennium was disputed in the first 3 centuries, but it was held by many. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it was eliminated. The belief in premillennialism was eliminated with Augustine and didn't reappear until the 19th century, really, in any significant way in Darby. Now, but the main thing that that Darby innovated, that we would say his system brought into being, was the pre-tribulation rapture. Now, that's not the same thing as premillennialism. Premillennialism means Jesus will come back before the 1,000-year reign. Pre-tribulationism means that the rapture of the church will take place before the tribulation. Now, the quote that you read from Ephraim, and this is usually called pseudo-Ephraim because scholars are not at all convinced that Ephraim really wrote this, but nonetheless, the quote seems to support a pre-tribulation rapture. And in that respect, it is very unusual for the times, if not unique. We don't know of any other writer in the first 18 centuries who, 17 centuries anyway, who even suggested a pre-tribulational rapture. And if Ephraim believed that, then he may have been the only one. We don't know. It's, over a period of thousands of years with millions of Christians on the earth, it's not surprising to find just about every view on every subject comes up once in a while, you know.
Right.
But Ephraim didn't have any influence on the theology of the church, his view on this, because the church never adopted it. nor had any church father before him that we know of held to it. So this could have been a unique view of Ephraim, or not. It may have been held by others that have left no record of it. But one thing we can say is the pre-tribulation rapture never became part of church theology until it was brought into the system of dispensationalism. And that there was Ephraim, and there was another guy whose last name is Morgan, who seemed to be pre-trib in the middle 1700s. This is not disputed, that Morgan Edwards, I'm sorry, was his name. And so these two guys, Ephraim and Morgan Edwards. Ephraim, we don't know when Ephraim wrote. They, 373 is the time that the real Ephraim of Nespis, or Ephraim of Syria, as he's sometimes called, wrote.
Right.
But many, many scholars doubt that Ephraim wrote this, so we don't know who wrote it.
I had checked it out on just quickly on Wikipedia, and they had mentioned that he mainly wrote poems and psalms, songs, and that there were a lot of apocryphal or pseudo-figuria writers that wrote saying that they were Ephraim. So we couldn't really verify that it was actually something that he wrote, but it could have been another person that wrote it.
Right, but somebody wrote it, and that's the important thing. It's, somebody before Darby taught something that sounds a lot like a pre-trib rapture. I mean, he's basically saying the church will be delivered before the great plagues will come. So that's very similar, if not identical, to what Darby taught. The difference is that Ephraim, as far as we know, or pseudo-Ephraim, whoever it was who wrote that, never integrated that into any kind of a theological system. As far as we know, we don't mm-hmm. find one recorded, and the church never adopted his views. So, again, throughout church history, I wouldn't be surprised if you found just about every conceivable opinion expressed by somebody or another if you had all their writings. That doesn't mean that it was ever a doctrine held by the church at large. And so Darby is the one who integrated a pre-trib rapture and premillennialism, both of which had been taught by some before him. He integrated those two things into a larger system of dispensationalism, and his system became extremely popular, so that, of course, there's many people, maybe the majority of evangelicals have adopted this dispensational system, which never happened before Darby came along.
So could we say that throughout the majority of church history that there were those that held a premillennial view, but the majority of the church held more toward an amillennial view?
Well, it's possible that there were some who held a premillennial view. We don't really have their writings. What we do find in the first three centuries, there were a number of church fathers who held a premillennial view. One of them was Justin Martyr. And he, in his writing to Trypho the Jew, his book called A Dialogue with Trypho the Jew, he mentioned that there were many Christians that he knew of who were, of the true and pure faith, he said, who do not accept his millennial position. Now, he was premillennial, but he was aware that lots of Christians were not. So in the first three centuries, we have reason to believe that amillennialism and premillennialism both existed side by side, and premillennialism was espoused by some pretty important people. But after Augustine, pretty much premillennialism disappeared for about, 1,400 years from the church. Now, there were some movements. I think the Waldenses and maybe a few others during that period of time may have held a premillennial view of some kind. But they didn't last long,
Right,
you can
right.
find all kinds of movements, both genuinely evangelical and cultic, associated with Christianity throughout history, and virtually every idea that's ever been held has been, espoused by somebody or another.
Okay. Well, hey, Steve, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. The guy that I read made it sound like it was a teaching that the whole church adopted, and I didn't know if that was true or not. So,
yeah, were you reading
my questions?
Were you reading Tommy Ice by any chance?
No, it was somebody else. I even forget who it was. It was just a couple weeks ago. But I saved the quote. I try to save certain quotes that are interesting to me and check them out later on when I can. But That was just kind of plaguing me.
When you look up, when you go online and look up pre-tribulation rapture, you're going to find some people list these quotes from Ephraim and from Morgan Edwards to prove that there was a pre-trib rapture believed by some before John Nelson Darby. And that is true. Right. There were some, but it was never part of the theology that, that the church adopted, you know.
Right. Okay, brother. Hey, thank you very much. Have a nice Christmas, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, Jack. Thanks for your call.
God bless you.
Bye now. And God bless you. We'll talk next to Richard from Seal Beach. And we have a line open for you also at 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Richard, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes. My question is, who wrote the book of Job? Is it the oldest book in the Bible? And did Job know the commandments of God? And I will hang up and listen to you on the radio.
All right. Well, as far as who wrote the book of Job, nobody knows for sure. It seems probable that Job may have written it, though it's also possible that there was another person present writing. You know, when we read the book of Job, for the first several chapters, we get the impression that Job and his three friends are the only people there. I mean, he's having a conversation, a dialogue with his three friends. And then all of a sudden, at near the end, another guy who's been there all along speaks up, a guy named Elihu, which means that although we've been reading only about this dialogue between Job and his three friends, Elihu is there, and we haven't been told about it previously. How many other people might have been there, we don't know. Job was a very well-known man in his day, and there could have been crowds around listening to this dialogue and some recording it. You never know. But the part that is difficult to know who wrote especially, or to know who could have written it, are the first two chapters. Because the first two chapters tell us of a negotiation between God and Satan going on, presumably in heaven, over what's going to happen to Job. Now, this would be information that no human person would have viewed. And therefore, it would have to be given by inspiration. So if the book of Job is true, and I take that it is, then it has to have been written by somebody who had some inspiration. They may also have been a witness to the speeches given by Job and his friends, and they may have recorded them. But they had to have some kind of prophetic revelation also to give us the information that's in chapters 1 and 2. Now, as far as I'm concerned, Job could be the guy. We know that although he's never referred to as a prophet, yet, near the end, God speaks to him audibly from heaven, and he talks back to God, and he and God have a conversation. God does most of the talking. But the point is that Job did receive revelation from God in the end of the book. And it may be that after it was all over, he also received revelation from God about the content of the first two chapters. Now, if that is so, then yes, Job would be the earliest book of the Bible. That was another one of your questions. Is Job the earliest book? Now, of course, Genesis tells us information that goes earlier than the story of Job, but Genesis is written by Moses, and Moses lived later. So although the book of Genesis goes further back in its narrative, the time of the writing of Genesis was later than the time of Job. So if Job or one of his contemporaries wrote the book of Job, then it was the earliest of the books of the Bible. Job, the reason people say that is because in the conversations in Job, there is no mention of God's covenant with Israel. There's no mention of tabernacle. It would appear that the worship of God in Job's day was done wherever someone wanted to do it. Job would set up an altar and offer offerings to God for his children. Apparently, he'd set up an altar wherever he happened to be living. Later on, once the law was given, godly people were supposed to go to the tabernacle to offer their sacrifices. But before the tabernacle, in the what we call the patriarchal period, people like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Job set up altars wherever they went. They just built an altar and sacrificed sheep on it for God. And there's evidence, therefore, in Job that he lived during the same time as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, not Abraham so much, because Job seems to be an Edomite. We don't know for sure that he was, but at least one of his friends was. And one of his friends was a Shuahite, Bildad the Shuahite. Now, the Shuahites descended from Shua, who was one of Abraham's children by Keturah. And then, of course, one of the one of his friends is Eliphaz, the Temanite. Now, the Temanites descended from Teman, who was one of Esau's sons. So, if Job's friends were descended from Shua and from Esau, that means they had to. Job had to be living at least after the time of Jacob and Esau. And very possibly sometime during the time that the Israelites were in Egypt. But it's hard to say. He may have been contemporary with Joseph. In any case, he would not know the law of God, not the law of God that was given at Sinai, anyway. But that doesn't mean that God had given no commandments to men. God said that Abraham would teach his children God's commandments in Genesis 18. So even Abraham knew commandments from God, but it wouldn't be the same commandments necessarily that we have cataloged in the law. There'd be some overlap, no doubt. I mean, for example, that you shouldn't murder or commit adultery. I'm sure that Abraham knew that long before it was in Mosaic law. So that would be my answer. Now, there is another possibility, of course. It is possible that Job lived back in the time that we're talking about, but that the book was not written so long ago. The book may have been written at a later time. And some people have thought it may have been written in the time of Solomon, when there was a lot of wisdom literature being written, and Job is a wisdom book. And so some feel that somebody in the time of Solomon, maybe even Solomon himself, wrote the book of Job, and that he was writing a true story about a man who had lived a long time earlier, but that the book wasn't written as long ago as Job lived. These are all speculations, but we aren't given the information as to who the true author is, and therefore we are at liberty to think different possibilities. In any case, whoever wrote it either was a prophet of God, which is what would qualify someone for writing an Old Testament book, or they were a false prophet because they claimed to be writing what God said and what God did and things that had to be given by revelation. So if that didn't really happen, then they're a false prophet. If it did really happen, then they're a true prophet. Now, James seems to indicate in James chapter 5 that Job is a true story. He says, "You've heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very merciful." And so James tells us that the book of Job essentially tells us something about the way God really is, and he treats it as if it's a true story. So if it's a true story, it must have been written by an inspired author, because of the revelatory information that's in it. Those would be my thoughts on the authorship of Job. I hope that may be helpful to you. Our lines are open, and if you'd like to be on the program, we only have less than 10 minutes, so you'd want to call right now to get your foot in the door before the weekend. If you have a question about the Bible or about the Christian faith, give me a call. Here's the number, 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. And before we take another call, I want to just let you know something that we've mentioned usually at the end of the program, but I have a little additional information I have to give you about this. You know the narrow path is listener-supported. You may notice that in our program we don't have any commercials. We don't sell any products. If you go to our website, we don't sell anything either. It's all free. Everything's free. So the expenses for running this ministry come from donations from listeners, merely. Now, every ministry that you're listening to on the radio is going to be asking you for money at the end of the year because they want to get their bills paid off and so forth, and some of them are in debt. I just want to let you know we're not in debt, and we're not in crisis. And we would like people to support the ministry because if you do, it keeps us on the air. But we're not in any crisis. We have no debt. We operate this ministry without debt and without overhead. We have no payroll. We have no office staff. There's nothing. I just do this in my own home, and I don't take any money for it, so it doesn't cost anything except what we pay the radio stations. However, what we pay radio stations is not an inconsiderable amount. We are on many radio stations between our two programs, and we spend about $30,000 a month paying for radio time. And all of that comes from listeners, but sometimes barely. And when it doesn't, then we have to consider dropping radio stations. So we just want you to know that we are listener-supported. I don't know of any station right now that's in danger of being dropped, but from time to time they are. And we just want you to know, if you want to, you can donate by going to our website, thenarrowpath.com. And another thing, my financial officer just told me I should make this announcement. I didn't know this. I don't even know what it means, but you will. He says, we can now accept appreciated assets such as stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. In case you are doing a year-end tax planning, email this address. You'll be reaching Frank if you do. It's donate@thenarrowpath.com to get details. So I don't know anything about finances. I don't know what appreciated assets are and so forth. I guess it's stocks. But he says we've now been set up with our bank account to be able to accept those kinds of things as well as cash gifts. So he wanted me to let you know. And if you want to find out details about that, you can email him. His name is Frank at, here's his email address, donate@thenarrowpath.com. All right. So I got that off my chest. He's been telling me to say that, and I haven't said it yet. All right, let's talk to Abel from San Diego. Welcome to The Narrow Path, Abel.
Oh, hi, Steve. Got a quick question about the Bible. How were the books of the Bible put together? Who put them together? I'll take your answer off there. I'll drop off. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call. Well, the books of the Bible were not all written at one time, of course, or even in one generation. They were written over a long span of time, about 1,600 years, 1,600 years, something like that. And there were 40 or so different authors. And so these books were just basically coming into existence over a long period of time in the Jewish community. They were writing other books, too, that didn't make it into the Bible. But the ones that got collected by the Jews in the Old Testament were those that seemed to have genuine prophetic authorship, someone like Moses or some other inspired person who got inspiration from God had to have written them, or else they weren't really considered to be the Word of God. And so over the years, the Jews collected those books where the authors seemed to have really been genuine prophets. Now, how would they know that? Usually it's because they predict the future and it comes true. And so if a prophet has done that, then he's got credentials. And if he wrote a book that he claims to be from God, then the fact that he successfully predicts the future gives him credibility. And so the Jews would collect books by people like this. Now, usually the Jews who heard the prophet speak in the prophet's lifetime didn't receive them. In fact, often they killed them. Many of the prophets were killed by their own countrymen. But later generations recognized that these men had spoken from God, especially by the fulfillment of their predictions. And so they would collect their books. 39 books, as they're currently edited, were collected by the Jews. It was a smaller number because what we call 1st and 2nd Kings was originally just one book, the Book of Kings. What we call 1st and 2nd Samuel was one book. What we call Ezra and Nehemiah were one book. What we call 1st and 2nd Chronicles were only one book. So we have 39 books in our Old Testament, but the Jews had a smaller number, but it was the same books. It was just that some of our books are two where they had one. We have two shorter books that used to be one long book. Now, this division into shorter books, in the case of Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, happened when the Septuagint was translated. The Jews in Alexandria, Egypt, about three centuries before Christ, decided to translate the Hebrew scriptures that they'd collected into Greek. Now, the Hebrew doesn't have vowels, but the Greek does, and therefore it would take up much more space on a page to write the same thing in Greek as it would in Hebrew. And that's why they divided, for example, Samuel into two books. It was just going to be too long to have one book in Greek. So they made 1st and 2nd Samuel. Same thing with Kings and Chronicles, Ezra and Nehemiah, and so forth. So this collection of Old Testament books was already in existence and being used by the Jews before Christ was born. So when Christ came into the world, in the Jewish world, they already had their old, what we call Old Testament scriptures. The New Testament scriptures, on the other hand, were written after Christ ascended and gave his spirit to his church. And the apostles wrote letters, especially, mostly letters and gospels. And these were accepted because of their apostolic origins. And the early Christians, just like the Jews had kept the writings of their prophets, the early Christians kept the writings of their apostles as much as they could. That is, they may have lost a few, but they kept as many as they could. Now, as far as the organization of these, I don't know who is responsible for putting them in the order they're in. In the case of our Old Testament order follows the Septuagint, I think, rather than the Hebrew Bible. But the Septuagint's the Greek translation that the Jews made of their Hebrew Bible. And all the historical books are put in the front. And they're essentially in chronological order, so it's sensible. Then you've got poetic books, largely, from the large ones to the small ones. And then you've got the prophets, and you've got major prophets who write longer books, followed by 12 minor prophets. This arrangement has been around with the Jews for hundreds of years before Christ came along, and the Christians have just adopted that arrangement. As far as the New Testament is concerned, it's organized in a reasonable way, too. I don't know who made the arrangement, but it's chronological. You've got the four Gospels, which tell the story of Jesus, in the front. Then you've got the book of Acts, which is the sequel to the Gospels. And then you have epistles, essentially arranged in order of size. Paul's epistles first, from the largest to the smaller ones, and then the epistles of other writers, likewise, Peter, James, John, Jude, and then the book of Revelations at the end, which probably for obvious reasons. Anyway, what the names of the people who actually put these together in that order, I don't know. But it was the whole church, the whole community of the church, deciding and preserving which writings were from the apostles that gave us the New Testament writings. I'm sorry we're out of time and we have other people waiting, but they'll have to wait till Monday. Call us again, please. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to go to our website, how to help us, go to thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Have a great weekend. God bless you.
Thank you, Steve, and we're so grateful for all of you out there listening, that you tune into The Narrow Path, and very importantly, that you support The Narrow Path. This is such an incredible service that Steve provides, giving answers to questions that perhaps you just don't know where else to turn to get an answer like that. And they are thoughtful and insightful, and we really want to be able to express our appreciation to Steve by giving him as much support as possible, and we hope that you'll do that. Go to his website, thenarrowpath.com, and you'll find a place there that it's very easy to find. It's the donations button, and you're ready to go. However, if you would like to be able to contact The Narrow Path in another way, you don't want to do it online, then call K-Bright. We'll give you additional contact information for Steve. Call us at 800-227-2337. Please keep in mind that the views and opinions on The Narrow Path are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, its ownership, management, or its advertisers. Stay with us for Joyce Meyer next on K-Bright.
Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Merry Christmas from this Crawford Broadcasting Station.
KBRT at KBRT HD Costa Mesa and on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled The Fearsome Four. Have you felt like life has been against you lately and there's a constant attack on your spirit? Do you feel any of these emotions? Worry, fear, guilt, or insecurity? If that's you, then stay tuned as Joyce is going to speak on what she calls the Fearsome Four. Each one of these emotions are attacks from Satan, and they're meant to drive you further from Christ and the plan he has for you. These strong emotions can make you feel trapped and that there is no way out. Joyce has faced these feelings as well, and today she wants to share with you how God helped her overcome these obstacles and live a confident new life. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, The Fearsome Four.
Father, thank you for the word today. I'm excited to share about how we don't have to live under guilt and condemnation. Jesus' name, amen. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. I said last night I'm talking about I'm just calling this series the Fearsome Four, because I believe in each one of these things that I'm talking about this weekend, fear is involved. The first one last night we talked about was fear itself. Today we're going to talk about guilt. One of the other two meetings left, we're going to talk about worry, and one of them insecurity. I haven't decided exactly which one I'm going to do tonight and which one tomorrow yet, but we need them all, don't we? There's probably nobody that doesn't need teaching on fear, keeping worry out of your life, guilt, and insecurity. How many of you experience guilt in your life? And it's a heavy burden that you just are fed up with, and you want to learn how to live on the other side of that. Well, I had a massive, massive, terrible problem with guilt in my life. And I can stand here today and say that although it was a tremendous fight and required a lot of study, I have been delivered, completely delivered from guilt and condemnation.